I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, environment, food, public policy, science, and the media. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between the different factors in our interconnected world that impact us, our communities, our society, and our global ecosystem. Each week on the show, I talk to different activists, thought leaders, authors, scientists, journalists, researchers, policymakers, economists, filmmakers, poets, and a whole host of people, each of whom has a different perspective on our interconnected world. On today's show, we are going to be dealing with the background to the current tragic and dangerous dynamic that is playing out in our country today. I'm referring to the incarceration and detention of young children from families seeking sanctuary here in the United States. This needs to be at the center of our focus. What we can do about it, why we are facing this problem, and we'll also discuss some of the political ramifications of that with today's guests, who I'm really thrilled to have with us. We'll be talking with today with Ana Maria Archila, who is the co-executive director at the Center for Popular Democracy and a national voice for immigrant justice, women's rights, and the urgency of a people-centered democracy. It's really important for us to understand both the background to this terrible devolution in the historic welcome to immigrants that has brought many of us to these shores through our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents, or we ourselves, why that's changing and what we can do about it, and what's happening right now, we'll be discussing with Ana Maria Archila. Welcome to Connect the Dots. It's really an honor to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
You know, right now we're in a situation where it has kind of gotten to a peak pitch and really crossed the line of what we have considered anything resembling normal or acceptable, or even beyond normal and acceptable for our society, with an outbreak of conflict between major public figures and a group of young, dedicated, hardworking, impassionate congressional women leaders elected in the 2018 election, who have really taken a strong stance for protecting the children and immigrants and acting directly on this current situation rather than just treating it like the new normal. And they have come under kind of a barrage of criticism and attack. Other people really regard them as heroines for, you know, leading the movement toward a more healthy, positive, humane, and caring way of dealing with this. From your perspective, as someone who has worked on immigrant justice issues and all of the other issues that are interrelated, just give our listeners, if you would, a snapshot of how you view the current situation, and then we can take a step back and look at how we got here and where we go from here.
Mm-hmm. So, first, thank you so much for creating the space to talk about the crisis that we're facing in regards to how our country is treating immigrant families, people seeking refuge in our borders today. Over the last year, the country has been exposed in many ways for the first time to the brutality and the cruelty of the immigration enforcement system, a system that for a long, long time has been separating families through detentions and deportations, and has been incarcerating and putting in cages both adults and children because of their effort to seek safety and opportunity for themselves and their families. So the, you know, the what we are seeing under Trump is a reinforcement of the most cruel aspects of our immigration enforcement system. Under Trump, we have seen the kind of rewriting of rules of how our country treats people who cross the border, the criminalization of migration, and the kind of deepening of the most cruel tactics, like the separation of families at the border, the caging of children. But I would be remiss if I didn't say that these kind of immigration enforcement system that we have today, which is actually the largest part of our criminal justice and our mass incarceration system, the you know, the largest law enforcement force that we have in this country is Border Patrol and ICE. That's the largest. And it's the most rogue kind of army of law enforcement agents. And the incarceration system that is attached to immigration enforcement is unique in both the fact that it incarcerates both adults and children, but also unique in the fact that it is most often a for-profit system. So 70% of the people that are sitting in immigration detention are sitting in private jails. 70%. So in addition to the fact that these are jails where children and families sit, there are corporations and individuals that are enriching themselves with under Trump's policies and with the kind of further enforcement only approach to immigration policy, which is what we have seen under Trump, is essentially a scapegoating of immigrants for political purposes. Trump has made immigration enforcement and anti-immigrant policies kind of the centerpiece of his political platform. And because he is able, by doing that, to tap into kind of the racist roots of, you know, our country, and to use anti-immigrant language and immigrant scapegoating to build and expand and kind of agitate the base that got him elected. So it's a very deliberate effort to essentially build and expand on the kind of racist underbelly of our country for political purposes. And at the end of the day, those who benefit from Trump's political platform are not his base, are the kind of corporate elites that he represents and whose interests he's ultimately charged with defending. So I will say Trump has used anti-immigrant policies to agitate his base, to get himself elected, to get more kind of white nationalist types elected, and to also distract his base from the fact that he has kind of his hands in their pockets. That at the same time that he's telling them that he's going to build the wall and separate families and throw people in detention facilities and deport entire families, he's also taking away people's health care. He's also, you know, giving massive tax cuts to the richest corporations and individuals in our country, and essentially kind of eroding the safety net that working class people and poor folks in this country build with their contributions and rely on. So it's a very erosive and dangerous, the use of anti-immigrant policies to erode what people, you know, the basically the ability of people to take care of each other in moments of crisis, when tragedy strikes, or when people are older. But Trump didn't just build this system from scratch. The immigration enforcement system that he's using and expanding and leaning on to advance his political vision his white nationalist vision was actually built over decades by both Republicans and Democrats, by Republicans who insisted on kind of a law enforcement approach to immigration, and by Democrats who were too complacent and willing to participate. Both the agencies that we have now, Customs and Border Patrol and ICE, were organized under the Department of Homeland Security back in 2001, right after 9/11, when DHS was created. And basically, immigration went from being a civil issue to being treated as part of kind of as a national security issue, and to we went from treating immigrants as like part of civil society to treating immigrants as potential terrorists, and using ICE and Border Patrol and all the immigration enforcement apparatus as part of a national security system. And so we have seen an incredible expansion of that system, both under Bush, under Obama, and under Trump. But with great peril for immigrant communities under Trump, someone who has made anti-immigrant policies the center of his political plan. And so now we see, you know, the country was exposed to images of children sitting in cages, of families sitting in cages, to the sounds of children crying for their parents last year in the summer when Trump was separating, or when the separation of families at the border came to light. And we saw an incredible display of kind of rejection of that from people across the country who marched in massive numbers, and, you know, came out to say, no, this is not who we want to be. And then we have seen more and more images of adults being, you know, warehoused in incredibly inhumane conditions, and children being warehoused in profoundly neglectful and inhumane conditions and dangerous conditions, and children dying and adults dying in detention facilities. And then we see the debate in Congress take the strangest turn when the leadership of the Democratic Party basically acquiesced to Trump's demands for more money for ICE and Border Patrol, supposedly for humanitarian aid through those agencies, which are fundamentally unable to be humanitarian agencies at core. So we saw
Let me just ask a debate.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, I'm glad that you brought this up, because this is, you know, you kind of have provided a really clear history of how the 9/11 events were hijacked for, in effect, criminalizing anyone foreign coming to this country as an immigrant as a terrorist, which is, of course, completely untrue, and that's not the reason that people are coming here. It's not as if it's impossible for some people, you know, a handful of people with those intentions, to kind of slip through. But the idea that we have redefined, you know, the melting pot, the welcome that is traditionally accorded to people, and instead redefined those people who are in need and want, they wouldn't be coming here otherwise, as terrorists and criminals. And then under the guise of doing that, created this for-profit system, and then ultimately, I'm just kind of summarizing what you said, you know, used it for a political end to fire up a base of people who are, you know, kind of in need, in want, and in kind of in their own hatred or bigotry, being misled down a pathway that is actually further enriching those at the very top of our society, you know, at the economic loss to others, but even of the loss of health, of life, of survival. You know, this
That's right.
Very, very cruel policy. And then, you know, as you've just begun to mention, it comes down to what can we do about it, and, you know, and what can the Congress, what can our federal legislators do about it, and the whole sort of original trigger for the current contention that we're seeing out there with, tweets and comments and statements by all sides, which we'll get into a little. But the kind of wellspring of that was, how was the Congress and the Senate going to act in this regard? And so you're referring to the current bill that, you know, a pattern of acquiescence from the Democrats, mm-hmm. and a recent piece of legislation, which maybe you can tell our listeners about, which really was a total failure in addressing the problem. And even in the understanding that we don't have a Democratic majority in the House or Senate, does that mean that nothing can be done? That, in fact, only complete abject surrender from the Democrats is the sole pathway. So if you could let our readers know a little bit about that legislation and kind of how it progressed and, proceeded and, what happened there, because that's what kind of ignited this current conflict, the differing views of that.
Yeah. So, let me give a little bit more background. So a lot of the images that people are seeing of and the stories that we're hearing of children being housed in border patrol facilities and adults being housed in border patrol facilities speak to a true crisis. There is a deep and big and unprecedented influx of people coming from Central America, escaping horrible violence and poverty and danger, coming to our borders in search of safety. And at numbers that are, and patterns of migration that are very different from, let's say, 10 years ago. 10 years ago, it was mostly adults, mostly men or women, adults coming to the border, escaping these regions, and now we see many families. So usually when people are detained at the border, in the past, they were mostly adults detained at the border who would be jailed in facilities controlled by Customs and Border Patrol. And those facilities are designed for short-term stays by adults. But right now, those facilities are housing, or rather warehousing and jailing and caging, both adults and children. Trump has changed the ways in which border crossing is punished and made it a criminal violation, which means that often adults are sent from Border Patrol jails into criminal prison and separated from the children that came with them. So those children are then thrown into either left in Border Patrol jails or sent to kind of the other system that exists to warehouse and to supposedly care for children and kind of the federal government, under the federal government's custody. But right now, people are stuck in these facilities, not for 72 hours, which is what they are designed to house people, mm-hmm. The length of time that they're designed to house people, but they're stuck for weeks. And, these facilities are not designed to house people for weeks. That's why they're saying, we don't have toothbrushes because people are not supposed to be here for more than 72 hours. They're not supposed to be here for weeks. And children are being left in these facilities for weeks and then transferred to other facilities that are also ill-designed to care for children for weeks and weeks. So they're sleeping in on the floor, in cement floors, or, on mats on the floors, covering themselves only with these blankets, these silver kind of paper blankets, and children caring for children, horrible conditions. Some people have an analysis that these conditions are the result of lack of resources. And some people think that these conditions are by design, cruel and negligent. And so the people who believe that they are, that these conditions are the result of lack of resources are saying, well, the solution is more resources for Border Patrol and for ICE. And the people who believe that, you know, these situation that we have right now is a situation that is by design, is intentional, is intentionally cruel, intentionally negligent, are saying the solution is not to give these agencies more money. The solution is to let people go, like leave empty these facilities and allow people to be in safe conditions with their families and go through an orderly process to be, you know, to be able to present their cases in immigration court. So these are, there's the different analysis. And the women that we know as the squad, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and Ayanna Pressley, led the fight to when Trump asked Congress for billions of dollars to give to Border Patrol and ICE to address, supposedly to address the humanitarian crisis. These women said, no, we do not trust Trump. We do not trust these agencies. They are cruel. They are rogue. They are dangerous. We should not give them more resources. And the fact is that if you look at the stories of how people have been warehoused and how people have been treated by ICE agents and Border Patrol, you will find a pattern of rogue behavior, of dangerous behavior, of inhumane behavior, of racist behavior. So the squad said to the leadership of the House, to Nancy Pelosi, we do not agree with the idea of giving these agencies more money. Other members of Congress tried really, really hard to put some conditions in place so that the House bill, the House proposal, would have teeth, would be able to ensure that this money was not given or was given with clear mandates to improve the conditions in which people were being housed and to shorten the stays and to make sure that people were able to have their day in court. But at the time of negotiation, basically, Nancy Pelosi and the leadership of the Democrats in the House basically just gave in without insisting on those conditions and basically accepted the Senate version of the legislation, which kind of granted billions of dollars to Trump's deportation force without conditions of on how to use the money. And that's why there was a big fracture with the new members of Congress led by the squad, AOC, Rashida, Ayanna, and Ilhan, saying, no, we will not vote for this legislation. And many of the members in the House basically being forced to vote with the leadership or just simply acquiescing and agreeing with the leadership that it was basically okay to give Trump this money without insisting on the conditions that members of Congress like Pramila Jayapal had worked really, really hard to put in the language of the legislation. So we saw a big
factor. Terrible.
It was just incredible.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing I don't understand, Ana Maria, is, you know, if these are private incarceration centers, then, and they're for profit, you know, they're, why should the government be funding them to make a profit? I mean, just to start, that seems like really inappropriate. I mean, before any profit comes, they have to fulfill, it would seem like, but apparently it's not legislated or regulated in any way. They need to fulfill basic safety and health requirements. They, you know, there need to be some rules governing what is or is not appropriate in terms of access to clean water, to hygiene, you know, uncrowding and all of that. So I don't understand why the government should even be subsidizing a for-profit system, you know, that's lining someone's pocket while, the, you know, a whole you know, the lives of children are being permanently damaged and placed at risk, and some are even dying. I mean, it just seems so incredibly confusing and terrible and crossing a line. And also, I don't understand how, and you know, people are being asked to believe that you know, people from the Democratic Party running for office will be able to take a lead in coping with this terrible and cruel and abusive overrule by the president and the Republican Party. How can they, you know, what promise of leadership and, you know, true initiative is being demonstrated here? I mean, I know that kind of politicizes the question, but it's rather, you know, it's truly, it's inappropriate on the one front, and it's concerning if we are then looking to this party, you know, to kind of restrain or put a leash on him if they want to start, or, you know, to take him out altogether through impeachment. If that is, you know, the ostensible plan or the hope, why, how can we have confidence in their ability to do that when they can't, they haven't functioned successfully on this through even listening, it seems like. Anyway, I'm sort of jumping the gun here, but.
No. On the kind of first part of your comment and question, it is one of the most remarkable facts about the immigration enforcement system of how much it relies actually on private industry to function. So one of the things that my organization has done, the Center for Popular Democracy has done, when Trump came into office, we realized that not only was he absolutely serious about the threat that he was making to immigrants, he was absolutely serious about his desire to make this country extremely hostile to immigrant families and to refugees, and dangerous for immigrant families and refugees. He was also very serious about kind of using his power to deliver for the corporate elite that he ultimately represents. And we started a campaign, we started an effort to try to understand who stood to benefit from Trump's anti-immigrant xenophobic policies. And what we discovered is that in order for those policies to be implemented, he needed the help of private industry. He needed the help of the corporations, the private prison corporations like Geo Group and CoreCivic. Those are the two largest private prison corporations. And in turn, those corporations needed the assistance, the financing of banks. And what we learned after doing a lot of research is that major banks like Wells Fargo, Chase, Bank of America, and some hedge funds like BlackRock and Blackstone and a few others were the primary sources of financing services and in some cases also investment. So we started a campaign to actually peel away, to make it extremely uncomfortable for these banks to continue to do that. Our campaign, called the Corporate Backers of Hate, eventually shone a light and, like, shamed and blamed these banks, which have, like, you know, a corporate personality of being about, you know, American families and, you know, mom-and-pop shops and, you know, small bank accounts for people. We shame them into separating themselves from these industry. And over the last 6 months, we have seen a string of banks saying that they will no longer finance private prisons. So Chase was the first one to announce that Chase is one of the largest corporations in the world, and somehow undocumented immigrants protesting in front of Jamie Dimon's house, And you know, getting like we did a protest that had mariachi bands in front of his house on Valentine's Day, and we infiltrated the shareholders meetings and had transgender women who had been in detention facilities in these private facilities tell their stories, and we sent letters to shareholders and did all kinds of tactics. Essentially forced one of the largest corporations in the world to say that they will no longer finance private prisons. And then Wells Fargo followed. And then Bank of America followed recently. And SunTrust and Parinas, some international banks just followed last week. So, and all about six different banks have announced that they will no longer finance private prisons.
Bravo, that is great work.
Amazing.
Wow.
Yes, and it has been the result of our efforts and the efforts of many organizations under the banner of Families Belong Together that have made this victory possible. And so we think that these private prison companies are going to have a really hard time functioning and essentially kind of expanding their business, because they need this financing in order to function in kind of their day-to-day, and especially in order to expand. So we're trying to choke the system that way. But it is true that for, you know, that it is a question that we have to ask. How come our government, our federal government, is essentially giving billions and billions of dollars to an industry that enriches itself, that makes business out of people's pain? And some of the Democratic candidates for president are naming these problems and making commitments in their platform. So Senator Warren just published her platform on immigration, and one of the points in her platform is saying she will no longer allow private prison companies to be contracted with the federal government for immigration enforcement, both because we have seen how inept they are and how dangerous the conditions are in these facilities, and how morally bankrupt it is to actually make business out of people's pain. So that's
absolutely
one important thing to know.
Yeah, and also it potentially, you know, sheds some light on why some, although I wouldn't know, and I don't know perhaps if you would or not, or we don't necessarily need to get into that today, but, you know, why there would be a group of Democrats, you know, kind of not wanting to define how this funding will be used, that may, in fact, wind up, you know, in the pockets of some of these, you know, some of these outlier banks that still are doing this, or some other companies to which they are beholden. Mm-hmm. So in effect, mm-hmm. you know, unless legislators take a strong stand against this, you know, one could suppose that, you know, it's possible that some of them are actually, their donors are benefiting or participating in this, whatever side of the aisle they may be sitting on. That is also very stressing. I don't know if that's a big factor, but
I think the way that I understand how kind of the rationale for Pelosi and some of the people that led kind of insisted on basically accepting the Senate version of the bill mm-hmm. was that they have the analysis that, you know, in order to solve the immediate crisis of what's happening inside the Border Patrol facilities and what's happening inside all of these other facilities that are overcrowded, that they needed to add resources, that they couldn't solve kind of the immediate crisis without resources. And even if they didn't like the agencies, even if they, you know, didn't want ICE and Border Patrol to be more resourced, they somehow believe that without resources, we couldn't solve the fact that people had no toothbrushes and no blankets and they were drinking water from the toilets. But, and I think they were scared of being blamed by Trump and the Republicans for the humanitarian crisis if they didn't immediately kind of acquiesce. But also, the Democrats have had, you know, like for the last 20 years, for as long as I've been organizing, basically we've been fighting to pass federal law that allows some people who are undocumented in this country to be legalized, to have a path to citizenship. And for the longest time, the analysis has been basically that in order to win legalization for some, we needed to accept the kind of enforcement, the like entrenchment of the enforcement apparatus. So more deportations, more detentions, militarization at the border. That's what was in the package that people referred to as comprehensive immigration reform. It was like border enforcement, interior enforcement, path to citizenship for like, you know, sometimes 3, sometimes 4, sometimes 7 million people, and then some kind of ability for business to get workers. That's what was called comprehensive immigration reform. And we and the movement, you know, even though we hated the enforcement aspect of it, we were trying to win legalization for people. So we kind of accepted that framework. But the fact is the framework only delivered more enforcement and more deportations and detentions and never delivered legalization, never delivered a path to citizenship for people. So, but the Democrats have kind of for 20 plus years have been attached to this idea that that is the viable, winnable solution to the immigration, the broken immigration system. But now the immigrant rights movement is pretty aligned around the idea that we cannot accept that framework anymore. That we cannot say, okay, yes, let's militarize the border in exchange for some path to citizenship for a few million. So we, I think, are having that. So part of the debate that's happening inside the party, the Democratic Party, is a debate both about what is the vision, what is the solution to the broken immigration system. And, you know, the squad is saying the solution needs to be a clear moral line. We need to be able to say without any caveats, we welcome people who are seeking refuge in our country into this country. We are a country that respects human rights, that values families, that understands that part of our history is welcoming immigrants. We need to say it without any hesitation. We need to say the enforcement system needs to be completely rebuilt, like reimagined. It is too dangerous. It is cruel. It is inhumane. We need to start from scratch. We need to abolish ICE. We need to imagine how to have immigration laws that are humane and that can be enforced humanely. And we need to move away from, you know, detaining people, detaining families, deporting people. That is not a solution. So some people want to say, let's imagine the world that is possible. And then there are people who say, well, but that's not reality. The world that is possible is not possible right now because we have Trump in office and we have Republicans in control of the Senate. So we need to do, you know, we need to play the politics of what's politically feasible right now. And but there is a tug of war in some ways between those who want to be visionary and say we can only get what we want if we actually name what we want and we try to fight for it, and those who are saying, well, that's nice, but actually not possible. That's, I want to do the politics of what's real. And so that's part of what's happening. And also, you know, the Democrats are being called to task on, like, taking some responsibility for the fact that, you know, we have an immigration enforcement system that they participated in creating. So that's where we are right now. And it's, but in these moments, we are doing a lot of work. The movement, the immigrant rights movement, is doing a lot of work to both engage people beyond immigrants in repudiating what's so cruel about our system and demanding that we be a humane country that respects the like basic rights of people to have to be with their families, to be safe, and to be treated with respect. And we are also trying to make sure that those who are running for president are speaking to a new vision, that they're no longer saying comprehensive immigration reform, because that is the old paradigm and it's a dangerous paradigm. We are asking them to be bold, to be visionary, to speak about how we are going to welcome people, how we are going to protect people's human rights, and how we are going to stop this cruel system from continuing to exist. So, you know, organizations like United We Dream and the Women's March and Indivisible and others are have put out, and my organization, the Center for Popular Democracy Action, have put out a framework that essentially asks presidential candidates to speak about the freedom to move in search of safety, community, and family, the freedom to stay in the place we call home, and the freedom to thrive, to have lives of dignity wherever we are.
That sounds good. I just want to mention to our listeners that you can support this and learn more about it, participate in actions, and much more by going to the website of today's guest, Ana Maria Archila, and the website, her organization is the Center for Popular Democracy, and they are found online at very easy to remember and great name, populardemocracy.org. And so they have a whole, you know, a group of really terrific campaigns. They unpack some of these issues, and there are regular opportunities for participating in campaigns either through donation or through action and participation, which many people have felt moved to do in this current situation. You know, to me, because I am the granddaughter of immigrants, and on two fronts, I just think all of these policies are so wrongheaded. One is that no one who has come to this country, you know, none of their families, none of their ancestors, none of our, you know, people, with the exception of Native American communities, you know, everyone came from somewhere else. Everyone emigrated, you know, so it's actually disrespectful to our own roots to think that, you know, somehow we have some claim. We're here now, and whoever comes next, you know, we shut the gate, because there isn't anyone apart from Native Americans or Black people brought here from Africa as slaves who did not, you know, do not come from backgrounds where they emigrated to this country. And, you know, the second thing is that I think the thing that's motivating a lot of this is, you know, a fear of economic want, a fear that there isn't enough for everyone, that somehow whoever comes through the door next is going to take bread away from one's own family. You know, when I speak with people, that's what I hear as really underlying this. And so the economic conditions that have been created to benefit the very wealthy and to deplete, you know, the poor, the lower middle class, the middle class, and it just keeps being ongoing, is really what's creating this desperate starvation, fearful mentality, when, in fact, you know, we've had economists on the show, and more will be coming, who really say this is all entirely unnecessary, and we could have what everyone needs for, you know, a humane life here, and in fact that immigrants can contribute to our communities, our economy, our country, and it, obviously because we're all, you know, majority of people are descended from immigrants, you know, in all sorts of ways, and that instead of having this kind of punitive approach to the economics with a model that enriches a very few, this could be better distributed, which hopefully, if the right candidate and candidates get elected in 2020, should, you know, be proceeding apace so that the needs of everyone can be met. And you know, obviously that's fueling all of this, and it's terrible. And if it gets to the point when we're repeating, you know, the U.S. is about treating people in this humane and dangerous fashion, you know, it's really, to me, it's a signature wake-up call issue that, you know, we've had enough. and this needs to change. You know, let's just, I mean, you know, you've done a beautiful job of describing the real context for, you know, the kind of flash fire point that ignited between, you know, at first Nancy Pelosi and the squad, and then, you know, of course, it was like went on from there, and, you know, the president, you know, weighed in on it in the ugliest possible fashion. Do you have any insights, you know, into the dynamic between Nancy Pelosi and the squad? I mean, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said that she felt that this treatment toward them, kind of dressing them down, saying, you know, go off of Twitter, you know, trying to humble them in some way, and call them to task for, you know, their right to hold this differently, was disrespectful. And, you know, some have called it racist as well. So I know that's a little bit more controversial, but, you know, I welcome your, you know, kind of perspective on that question.
So I found you know, put like that interaction between the speaker and the members of the squad to be puzzling, honestly. Why would I don't understand the value of trying to kind of silence or quiet or reprimand or discipline members of Congress who have ignited so much interest and so much excitement of young people, of people of color across the country who feel a sense of renewed hope and who see in the squad and other members of Congress from this new generation a sense that we can actually expect from political leaders both vision and courage and moral clarity. And I think, you know, I also find it puzzling kind of on a political sense. When Speaker Pelosi was running for speaker, the members of the squad had her back and stood by her and supported her leadership, and it was the blue dog Democrats, the more centrist, more kind of right-wing Democrats who were making the case for someone else to be leader and undermining her ability to exercise her own leadership. So I found it puzzling that she would kind of reprimand members of, you know, of the squad. And also a terrible look to have a white woman leader kind of castigate young women of color for taking a courageous stand. So the whole thing was very disappointing, I would say, and you know, essentially gave cover and paved the way for some of Trump's extremely racist and xenophobic comments, and paved the way for kind of a legitimizing of Trump's racism by his own party. So, you know, I think the speaker kind of had to backtrack and a little bit eat her words as she had to kind of introduce this resolution in Congress yesterday condemning the president and kind of turn her attention from castigating members of her own caucus to fighting the actual dangerous person in the White House who is who is causing some real harm to immigrant families and long-term harm to immigrant children and so much harm to people in this country. I think that, you know, it's also the fact is that there is a struggle inside the Democratic Party for the future of the Democratic Party. What kind of party is it going to be? Is it going to be a party that welcomes and stands up and represents the visions, the aspirations, the life experiences of people who are struggling in this country, of Black folks, of Latinx folks, of immigrant folks, of white working class folks, of Native American folks, or is it going to be a party that is willing to represent the interests of corporate elites and kind of have liberal stances but not necessarily more radical solutions to the problems that we're facing that are urgent and real, like the climate crisis, like the profound humanitarian crisis that immigrants are facing at the border and in the interior under Trump.
Yes. That certainly is real. You know, what comes to my mind, and I'm not sure if it's a helpful metaphor, but the whole dynamic in which Pelosi, instead of turning the ire on Trump and the Republicans and, you know, making them accountable through this legislation for doing the right things with the money and defining what that is, instead just kind of left them an open purse to do with as they wish, which was not really, based on their track record, they should never have been accorded that. And then instead turning around and chastising the people who were very rightly calling that out. And it reminds me a bit of like an abusive and enabling family dynamic or other dynamic where because you can't speak truth to the powerful tyrannical dominator in the situation, then you instead beat up the children, or, you know, you're in effect, she appears to be, in what looks to me, coming from a background in counseling and other stuff where I've seen these kinds of things, like an enabling, parent who, can't take those steps and is in some way afraid to leave the system herself, maybe, you know, or themselves, you know, in terms of all the legislators with her, not to personalize this, but, you know, it's more comfortable and habitual, perhaps, to function in an enabling role. And then to blame other people for it. I mean, I don't know why on this particular issue it, you know, push came to shove, but that was my, you know, kind of, that's what it reminded me of symbolically. And then it doesn't bode well to people, you know, having confidence in the Democratic Party and whomever it provides, which is what, you know, a lot of people are saying, whomever is nominated, we all should stand with. It doesn't provide confidence or trust in their ability to provide the right candidates. So I don't know if you share that view, but...
I mean, I don't know. I don't feel comfortable kind of venturing into a kind of analysis that's like a somewhat psychoanalytic analysis of her behavior, mm-hmm. any of their behaviors. I know that, you know, like Speaker Pelosi is a tenacious leader and has led really significant fights and has, you know, both under Trump and before, and has the respect and the admiration of many women across the country, many people across the country, many in her party, and at the same time, she has been part of the establishment to some extent for a long time, and there is an internal struggle inside the Democratic Party for the future of the party, and there is a generational struggle. So there are lots of dynamics happening, and then there are substantive disagreements. I want to believe that She both has political disagreements with the squad and substantive disagreements. And there are, and that is important and healthy for any kind of political process to exist. What is not healthy is efforts to silence or undermine the voices of people who represent people fundamentally. And that's where I think she failed. And where she had to backtrack and correct after Trump, when after the squad in a more kind of intense way. But I think that the struggle inside the Democratic Party is an important struggle. It is something that gives me hope. I don't know how we build a country where we can all be free if we don't change the way that politics happens in this country, if we don't change the relationship that people have with our democracy and the relationship that people have with the parties, if we don't build other vehicles for people to express more bold aspirations for what our country could be. And so, you know, I have helped and continue to help building the Working Families Party, which is a third party, very vibrant and important in some states like New York, Connecticut, and in about 13 states in the country. And it's fundamentally about pushing the Democratic Party to be a party that represents the interest of communities that are struggling. And that speaks to the history of this country, not a whitewashed history, but the real history of this country, a history where we are living every day the legacy of racism and slavery in this country. We are living every day the legacy of a patriarchal kind of ideology that also shaped this country. And we are constantly struggling for more of us to be included in the promise of freedom and democracy. And that promise cannot be fulfilled without people struggling and fighting for themselves, for their lives, for the people they love, and for the country that we want to live in.
Thank you. We're coming to the end of our show today, and we've been talking with Ana Maria Archila of the Center for Popular Democracy. Please check out their website, contribute, get involved in their campaigns at populardemocracy.org. Thank you so much for being with us today, Ana Maria Archila on Connect the Dots. It's been great having you. And thank you, listeners, for joining us today. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern on the Progressive Radio Network with Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Heads up, keep marching forward in company with all our relations.